Chapter 11, reading from The Nature of Personal Reality, a Seth book by Jane Roberts. Now, Seth, the next chapter, 11, to be titled, The Conscious Mind as the Carrier of Beliefs, Your Beliefs in Relation to Health and Satisfaction. That is the heading. The nature of your personal beliefs in a large measure directs the kind of emotions you will have at any given time. You will feel aggressive, happy, despairing, or determined according to events that happen to you, your beliefs about yourself in relation to them, and your ideas of who and what you are. You will not understand your emotions unless you know your beliefs. It will seem to you that you feel aggressive or upset without reason, or that your feelings sweep down upon you without cause, if you do not learn to listen to the beliefs within your conscious mind, for they generate their own emotions. One of the strongest general causes of depression, for example, is the belief that your conscious mind is powerless either in the face of exterior circumstances thrust upon you from without, or before strong emotional events that seem to be overwhelming from within. Psychology, religion, science, in one way or another, all of these have added to the confusion by stripping the conscious mind of its directing qualities and viewing it as a stepchild of the self. The schools of positive thinking try to remedy the situation, but often do more harm than good because they attempt to force beliefs upon you that you would like to hold, but do not in your present state of confusion. Many such philosophies make you cower at the idea of entertaining negative thoughts or emotions. In all cases, the clues to your emotional experience and behavior lie in your systems of belief, some more evident to you than others, but all available to you consciously. If you believe that you are of little merit, inferior, and filled with guilt, then you may react in several ways according to your personal background and the framework in which you accept those beliefs. You may be terrified of aggressive feelings because it seems others so much more powerful than you could retaliate. If you believe that all such thoughts are wrong, you will inhibit them and feel all the more guilty, which will generate aggressiveness against yourself and further deepen your sense of unworthiness. Now, if you read a book in your situation that instructs you to contemplate goodness, to turn your thoughts immediately to love and light when you feel irritated, you are in for trouble. Such practices will only serve to make you more frightened of your natural emotions. You will not understand why you have them any better than you did before. You may only hide them more cleverly and perhaps become ill if, given the situation, you are not already. The harder you try to be good in such a case, the more inferior you will become in your own mind. What do you think of yourself, your daily life, your body, your relationship with others? Ask yourself these questions. Write down the answers or speak them into a recorder, but in one way or another, objectify them. When you feel the rise of unpleasant emotions, take a moment and make an effort to identify their source. The answers are far more available than you may have previously believed. Accept such feelings as your own in the moment. Do not shove them underneath, ignore them, or try to substitute what you think of as good thoughts. Be, first, aware of the reality of your feelings. As you become more aware of your beliefs over a period of time, you will see how they bring forth certain feelings automatically. A man who is sure of himself is not angry at every slight done to him, nor does he carry grudges. A man who fears for his own worth, however, is furious under such conditions. The free flow of your emotions will always lead you back to your conscious beliefs if you do not impede them. Your feelings always change the chemical balance of your body and alter its hormonal output. But the danger comes only when you refuse to face the contents of your conscious mind. Even the intent to know yourself, to face the reality of your experience, can be of great benefit, generating emotions that will provide an energy, an impetus to begin. No one can do this for you. You may believe that good mental health means always being cheerful, resolute, and kind, and never crying or showing disappointment. That belief alone can lead you to deny quite natural dimensions of human experience and to impede the flow of emotions that would otherwise cleanse both your body and your mind. If you are convinced that feelings are dangerous, then again, that belief itself will generate a fear of all of them, and you may become almost panic-stricken if you display anything but the most reasonable, calm behavior. Your emotions then may strike you as highly unpredictable, extremely powerful, and to be kept down at all costs. Such an attempt to strangle natural feeling is bound to take its toll, but it is the belief itself that is to blame and not the emotions. Any of the conditions mentioned puts you out of touch with your inner sense of balance. The natural grace of your being becomes disturbed. The conscious mind is meant to align all of your capabilities in accordance with its beliefs about the nature of reality. Those resources are considerable, for they include the deepest aspects of your creativity and powers far beneath consciousness of which you are only dimly aware. You cannot will yourself to be happy while believing that you have no right to happiness or that you are unworthy of it. You cannot tell yourself to release aggressive thoughts if you think it is wrong to free them. So you must come to grips with your beliefs in all instances. If you have been told, again, that the spirit is good, in fact perfect, and that you must then be perfect in all your ways, while at the same time you believe in the imperfection of the body, you will always be in conflict with yourself. If it seems to you that the soul is degraded by its alliance with the flesh, then you will not be able to enjoy your own sense of grace, for you will not consider it possible. Your beliefs will dictate your very interpretation of various kinds of emotions. Many people, for example, are convinced that anger is always negative. It can be the most arousing and therapeutic emotion under certain circumstances. You can then realize that you have cowered before contradictory beliefs for years, rise up in anger against them, and quite literally begin a new life of freedom. Normal aggressiveness is basically a natural kind of communication, particularly in social orders, a way of letting another person know that in your terms they have transgressed, and therefore a method of preventing violence, not of causing it. In animals, natural aggression is used with the greatest biological integrity. It is on the one hand ritualized, and on the other hand perfectly spontaneous. Its signals are understood. The various degrees, postures, the indications of natural animal aggressiveness are all steps in a series of communications in which the animal encounters are made clear. To a large extent, a highly involved series of symbolic actions are carried out long before any battle takes place, if it does finally. The display of the aggressive behavior, however, far more frequently prevents an actual combat situation. Man has highly charged contradictory attitudes about aggression, and his beliefs about it cause many of his mass and private problems. Rob notes, Jane paused, still in trance. She had picked up a fresh cigarette, then discovered that she was out of matches. Wait a minute, I said. I'll get you a light. I was glad of the chance to rummage around. The pace had been fast. Seth, he and I both thank you. To some degree, we will touch upon those dilemmas in this book. In your society and to some extent in others, the natural communication of aggression has broken down. You confuse violence with aggression and do not understand aggression's creative activity or its purpose as a method of communication to prevent violence. You deliberately make great effort, in fact, to restrain the communicative elements of aggression while ignoring its many positive values, until its natural power becomes dammed up, finally exploding into violence. Violence is a distortion of aggression. Give us a moment. Birth is an aggressive action, the thrust outward with great impetus of the self from within a body into a new environment. Any creative idea is aggressive. Violence is not aggressive. It is instead a passive surrender to emotion, which is not understood or evaluated, only feared, and at the same time sought. Violence is basically an overwhelming surrender, and in all violence there is a great degree of suicidal emotion, the antithesis of creativity. Both killer and victim in a war, for instance, are caught up in the same kind of passion, but the passion is not aggressive. It is its opposite, the desire for destruction. Know that yearning is made up of feelings of despair caused by a sense of powerlessness, not of power. Aggressiveness leads to action, to creativity, and to life. It does not lead to destruction, violence, or annihilation. Let us take a very simple example involving a kind and good man in a fairly ordinary environment within your society. He has been taught that it is manly to be aggressive, but he believes that this means fighting. As an adult, he frowns upon fighting. He cannot hit his boss, though he may want to. At the same time, his church may tell him to turn the other cheek when he is upset, and to be kind, gentle, and understanding. His society teaches him that such qualities are feminine. He spends his life trying to hide what he thinks of as aggressive, violent behavior and trying to be understanding and kind instead. The stereotype is, of course, unrealistic, having to do with distorted concepts concerning the male and the female. But here we will merely consider the aspects of aggressiveness. Because he is trying to be so understanding, our man inhibits the expression of many of the natural irritations that would serve as a natural system of communication between, say, his superior and himself at work, or perhaps with the members of his family at home. Simultaneously, all of these inhibited reactions seek release, for the manifestation of aggressive feelings sets up natural balances within the body itself, as well as serving as a communication system with others. When his system has had enough, our friend may then indeed react with violent behavior. He may suddenly find himself in a fight, initiating one, and the smallest incident may serve as a trigger. He could seriously hurt himself or someone else. As a rule, the animals have better sense. Your mind and your body, therefore, are quite equipped to handle aggression. Violence occurs only when the natural expression of aggression has been short-circuited. The sense of power felt during such episodes is the result of repressed energy suddenly released. But the individual is always at the mercy of that energy then, submerged within it, and passively carried with it. The fear of your own emotions can do far more damage than their expression, because the apprehension builds up a charge that intensifies the energy behind them. Now you may take your break. Now, Seth, because you have conscious minds, you have great leeway in the manner in which you can express aggression, but the animal's heritage is still retained in its own way. A frown is a natural method of communication, saying, "You have upset me," or "I am upset." If you tell yourself to smile when you feel like scowling, then you are tampering with the natural expression and denying to another a legitimate communication that tells how you feel. When a man or woman always smiles at you, the smile can be like a mask. You do not know whether or not you are communicating with such a person. The sound of the voice, again, follows its own patterns. The natural aggression should and will color it at times. There are many biological signs shown by the body, all meant as communications to others on a creative basis, as warnings to whatever degree. Each is automatic in its own way and yet ritualistic, a dance of muscle in emotion with its own meaning and biologically understood. These are all constructive. They are meant to elicit reactions from others and to arrive at new points of understanding, a battle of rights. When your conscious thoughts interfere with such processes, you are in deep trouble. The animal's behavior pattern is more limited than your own, in a way freer and more automatically expressed, but narrower in that the events an animal encounters are not as extensive as your own. You cannot appreciate your spirituality unless you appreciate your creaturehood. It is not a matter of rising above your nature, but of evolving from the full understanding of it. There is a difference. You will not attain spirituality or even a happy life by denying the wisdom and experience of the flesh. You can learn more from watching the animals than you can from a guru or a minister, or from reading my book. But first you must divest yourself of the idea that your creaturehood is suspect. Your humanness did not emerge by refusing your animal heritage, but upon an extension of what it is. When you try to be spiritual by cutting off your creaturehood, you become less than joyful, fulfilled, satisfied natural creatures, and fall far short of understanding true spirituality. Many who say they believe in the power of thought are so afraid of it that they inhibit it in themselves, avoiding any that appear negative or harmful. The slightest aggressive expression is blocked. Thoughts can kill, these people think, as if the individual against whom such an impulse was directed had no protective life-giving energies of his or her own and no natural defense. Here, however, and for various reasons, you find a hidden and distorted sense of power that says, I am so powerful that I could kill you with my thought, and yet I refuse to do so. No one, and no one thought, is that powerful. If thoughts alone could kill, you would not have the overpopulation problem. Each person has his own built-in energy and protection. You accept only those ideas and thoughts that fit in with your system of beliefs. And even then, there are various safeguards. No man dies unless he wants to die, and for a much better reason than that you may want him to. Sometimes you think of suicide as ignominious and passive, but of war as aggressive and powerful. Both are equally the result of passivity and distorted aggression, and of natural pathways of communication not used or understood. You think of flowers in terms of gentleness, beauty, and goodness, and yet every time a new bud opens, there is a great thrust of joyful aggression that is hardly passive, and a daring and courage that reaches actively outward. Without aggression, your body would be denied its growth, the cells within it caught in inertia. Aggressiveness is at the base of the magnificent bursting of creativity. Now, that is the end of dictation, and the end of our session. If you want something on probabilities, I will give it to you at another time, and it will be, though briefly, discussed along with some material on reincarnation in this book. Rob notes, lately I've been asking Jane if she thought Seth would give at least a short dissertation on probabilities for this book. I've been especially curious about this since we received this information on the death of our cat, Rooney, in the 639th. Now Seth made some suggestions about how the members of the ESP class could, by following the data in this session, write down their individual beliefs for group discussion. Seth, then I will give a progress report at a later time. Rob, all right. Seth, I bid you a fond good evening, and have Rupert show you his latest paper. Rob, yes, thank you, Seth. Good night. Session 643, February 26, 1973. Reading from The Nature of Personal Reality, a Seth book by Jane Roberts. Seth, good evening. Rob, good evening, Seth. Seth, dictation. Today, Rupert received a call from a young woman I will name Andrea. She is a lovely young blonde. I would like to use this instance as an excellent example of the ways in which conscious beliefs affect your feelings and behavior. Andrea is in her early 30s, divorced with 3 children. She called to tell Rupert that she had lost her job this morning, but more than this, that she was involved in a week of very negative circumstances and emotional encounters. A young man she had been seeing began to avoid her. A salesman placed her in what seemed to be a very humiliating situation and yelled at her in front of a crowd of people. All of her own encounters of late had seemed to follow the same pattern. Finally, she became ill and emotionally overwrought. She stayed home from work, and that situation culminated in the loss of her job. She told Rupert that she felt herself to be an inferior person, unable to cope, and an individual who was not able to hold her own with her co-workers or the world at large. She had carried those beliefs, of course, through that period of time, and they were expressed unconsciously through her body, through gestures, expressions, tones of voice. The whole physical self expected rebuffs. The events of those days, whatever they were, would be interpreted in the light of that mental set. All of the available data coming into the organism would be sifted, weighed, and valued in a precise search for the material that would give physical emphasis to those beliefs. Information or events running counter would be ignored to a large degree or distorted to such a fashion that they would be made to fit in with what the mind said was reality. Conscious beliefs focus your attention, channel it, and direct your energy so that you can swiftly bring the ideas into your physical experience. They also act as blinders, throwing aside data that cannot be assimilated while preserving the integrity of the beliefs. So our Andrea did not see or ignored the smiles that came her way or the encouragement. And in some cases, she even perceived some potentially beneficial events as negative. These then were used to further reinforce the belief in her own inferiority. Over the phone, Rupert reminded Andrea of her own basic uniqueness and also of the fact that she was creating her reality through beliefs. Rupert reinforced other ideas that Andrea had momentarily forgotten, the fact, among others, of her own true worth. And because Rupert believed in Andrea's worth, and because Andrea knew it, this more positive belief rose up to shove the others aside. During the day, Andrea was able to look at both beliefs and see them as opposing ideas that she had held about herself. She believed she was unique and good, and also that she was inferior and bad. At various times, one belief would color her experience nearly to the exclusion of the other. Just before this session, Andrea called back. She realized that she had indeed set up the situation by not dealing honestly with her own conscious ideas. She had wanted to leave her job for another one, but was afraid of taking the step. So she created circumstances in which the decision was seemingly taken out of her hands. It would appear as if she were the victim of unfeeling co-workers, jealous and misunderstanding, and a boss who would not stand up for her. Now she understood that she was not a victim, but the originator of those conditions. During the time involved, her feelings faithfully mirrored her conscious beliefs. She was lost in self-pity and self-condemnation. These brought about the weakened body state. In speaking to her the second time, Rupert gave Andrea excellent advice, explaining the way in which such feelings can be handled to advantage. In his or her own way, each reader can easily utilize the method. Rupert advised Andrea to accept the validity of such feelings as feelings, not to inhibit them, but to follow their flow with the understanding that they are feelings about reality. As themselves, they are real. They express emotional reactions to beliefs. The next time Andrea feels inadequate, for example, she is to actively experience that feeling, realizing that even though she feels inferior, this does not mean that she is inferior. She is to say, "I feel inferior," and at the same time to understand that the feeling is not a statement of fact, but of emotion. A different kind of validity is involved. Experiencing your emotions as such is not the same as accepting them as statements of fact about your own existence. Andre is then supposed to ask, "Why do I feel so inferior?" If you deny the validity of the emotion itself and pretend it away, then you will never be led to question the beliefs behind it. Rob notes, long pause at 9:56. Seth, "I am simply giving you a moment to rest your hand." "You're not resting it." Rob, "Yes, I am," I said jokingly, putting my pen down after I had finished these notes. As Seth, Jane stared at me soberly. Seth. At this point, Andrea believes that her life must be difficult. She has been told often that a woman without a man is in a very difficult situation, particularly a woman with children. She believes that a new mate will be almost impossible to find. She has been informed that children need a father, and feels at the same time that no man wants to become involved with a woman with children. In her 30s, it seems to her that youth is fast fleeing, and in line with her beliefs, she cannot see a woman who is much older being desirable. So her beliefs put her in a state of crisis. Change them, and no crisis exists. The body would then cease reacting to such stress, and almost immediately the exterior situation itself would be altered. At the same time, all beliefs are communicated to others, not only through quite unconscious bodily mechanisms, but telepathically. You will always try to correlate your ideas with exterior experience. All of the abilities of the inner self will be brought to bear to materialize the image of your beliefs, regardless of what they ought to be. The proper emotions will be generated, bringing about those bodily states that exist in your conscious mind. Now, this was a way of assisting the young woman involved and others too. Show her this session. There will be no problem. The situation is one in which many young women are involved, and this material can help them solve dilemmas of which they may have been unaware previously. They do not know a Rupert, but they can learn through this book. Now you may take your break. Rob. All right. Jane laughed when I said I'd been hoping Seth would respond to my comments in that manner. Seth. I have used Andrea because so many typical Western beliefs coincide in her reality. The idea that aging is disastrous, that women are relatively powerless without a man beside them, that life is, practically speaking, highly difficult, while it should be ideally simple. All of these ideas obtain their charge from a basic belief in the powerlessness of the conscious self to form and regulate its experience. Luckily, Andrea is working with her own system of beliefs. Presently, however, while she tells herself that age does not matter, she still believes that her desirability as a woman decreases with the passage of each day. So she feels and acts less attractive when that belief holds sway. She is fortunate enough to be able to check her physical experience against her beliefs, and astute enough to see areas in which she has made great advances. But let us look at some of those beliefs and apply them to others generally. Often, of course, those who try the hardest to be good do so because they fear for their basic worth, and those who speak of having youthful minds and bodies do so because they are terrified of age. In the same way, many who shout about independence are afraid that they are basically helpless. In most instances, those opposing beliefs are held quite consciously, but kept apart from each other. Therefore, they are not reconciled. Since your feelings follow your beliefs, various groups of them will appear to be senseless at times if you do not allow them free connection with opposing ideas that you may also hold. A person may seem to be very open and responsive. Reading this book, for example, any reader might say, "My trouble is that I am too emotional." Yet on some self-analysis, almost all will find areas in which emotions are expressed only to a certain point. They are not followed through. No feeling brings you to a dead end. It is in motion, and that always leads into another feeling. As it flows, it alters your entire physical condition, and that interchange is meant to be consciously accepted. Your emotions will always lead you into a realization of your beliefs if you do not impede them. Emotional states are always impetuses for action, meant to be physically expressed. Each has a basis in natural aggression. The connections between creativity and aggression have never been understood in your society. A misunderstanding of true aggression can lead into a fear of all emotion and cause you to cut yourself off from one of nature's best therapies. Natural aggression provides the charge for all creativity. Now, reading this, many readers will be taken back, for they believe that love is the impetus, and that love is opposed to aggression. There is no such artificial division. Natural aggression is the creative loving thrust forward, the way in which love is activated, the fuel through whose agency love propels itself. Aggression, in the most basic terms, has nothing to do with physical violence as you think of it, but with the force through which love is perpetuated and creatively renewed. When you think in other terms, then you fall into distorted views in which power is assigned to negative elements and seen as threatening, wrong, or even given demonic connotations. In contrast, good is seen as weak, powerless, passive, and in great need of defense. You will be afraid of any powerful emotion, therefore frightened of the dimensions of your own actuality, and to a large extent being led to run away from an acceptance of the power and energy of your own being. You will be forced to dilute your own experience. Such beliefs have a strong depressing characteristic that can lead you to shut down powerful feelings by immediately considering them negative. You will automatically begin to inhibit any stimulus that might bring about forceful emotions, and so deny yourself needed feedback. You are at the mercy of your emotions only when you fear them. They are the motion of your being. They go hand in hand with your intellect. But when you are unaware of the contents of your conscious mind and not fair with your emotions, you run into difficulty. Session 644, February 28, 1973. Reading from The Nature of Personal Reality, a Seth book by Jane Roberts. Seth, good evening. Rob, good evening, Seth. Seth, dictation. Rupert did receive some information from me by using another method. Some advanced material was given to him for his own use ahead of time, so to speak. It seemed to him that the information just came, but not already prepared into words. Instead, he received ideas which he then interpreted and verbalized, and wrote down for himself. That material is pertinent and belongs in this chapter. I will give it in my own way now. I have often stated that the mind-body relationship is one system. The thoughts are as necessary to the whole system as the body's cells are. Rupert correctly interpreted an analogy I gave him in which I compared thoughts to individual cells, the belief systems to the physical organs, which are composed of cells. The organs obviously are stationary in the body, though the cells within them die and are reborn. Belief systems are as necessary and natural as physical organs are. In fact, their purpose is to help you direct the functioning of your biological being. You give no conscious thought to the coming and going of cells within your organs. Left alone, your thoughts will come and go through your belief systems just as naturally. And ideally, they will balance out, maintaining their own health and directing your body so that its innate therapies take place. Your systems of belief will, of course, attract certain kinds of thoughts, with their trails of emotional experience. A steady barrage of hateful, revengeful thoughts should actually lead you to look for the beliefs from which they are gaining their strength. You cannot do this by ignoring the validity of the thoughts as your experience, however, by trying to shove them under the rug of a superficial optimism. Such habitual, unhappy thoughts will bring about the same kind of physical experience, but it is your own system of beliefs that you must examine. The negative, subjective, and objective events that you meet are meant to make you examine the contents of your own conscious mind. In their way, the hateful or revengeful thoughts are natural therapeutic devices, for if you follow them, accepting them with your own validity as feelings, they will automatically lead you beyond themselves. They will change into other feelings, carrying you from hatred in what may seem to be the quicksands of fear, which is always behind hatred. By going along with feelings, you unify your emotional, mental, and bodily state. When you try to fight or deny them, you divorce yourself from the reality of your being. Dealing with thoughts and feelings as just directed at least roots you firmly in the integrity of your present experience and allows its innate motion, the natural creativity, to thrust toward a therapeutic solution. When you refuse such emotions or become terrified of them, you impede the flow of feeling from one moment to the other. You set up dams. Any emotion will change into another if you experience it honestly. Otherwise, you clog the natural movement of your entire system. Fear, faced and felt, with its bodily sensations and the thoughts that go along with it, will automatically bring about its own state of resolution. The conscious system of beliefs behind the impediment will be illuminated, and you will realize that you feel a certain way because you believe an idea that causes and justifies such a reaction. If you habitually deny the expression of any emotions, to that degree you become alienated, not only from your body, but from your conscious ideas. You will bury certain thoughts and put up biological armor to prevent you from physically feeling their effects upon your body. In each case, the answer lies in your personal system of beliefs, in those strong concepts you hold on an intimate level that brought about the inhibitions to begin with. If you find yourself running around in a spiritual frenzy, trying to repress every negative idea that comes into your head, then ask yourself why you believe so in the great destructive power of your slightest negative thought. The body and mind together do present a united, self-regulating, healing, self-clearing system. Within it, each problem contains its own solution, if it is honestly faced. Each symptom, mental or physical, is a clue to the solution of the conflict behind it, and contains within it the seeds of its own healing. You may take a break. Rob notes, Jane said that during the delivery she knew, without being aware of what Seth was saying, that he was talking about the material she'd received on her own earlier in the week. Seth, now, it is true that habitual thoughts of love, optimism, and self-acceptance are better for you than their opposites, but again, your beliefs about yourself will automatically attract thoughts that are consistent with your ideas. There is as much natural aggressiveness in love as there is in hate. Hate is a distortion of such a normal force, the result of your beliefs. As in the material that Rupert received ahead of time for his own use, natural aggression is cleansing and highly creative, the thrust behind all emotions. There are two ways to get at your own conscious belief. The most direct is to have a series of talks with yourself. Write down your beliefs in a variety of areas, and you will find that you believe different things at different times. Often there will be contradictions readily apparent. These represent opposing beliefs that regulate your emotions, your bodily condition, and your physical experience. Examine the conflicts. Invisible beliefs will appear that unite those seemingly diverse attitudes. Invisible beliefs are simply those which you are fully aware but prefer to ignore because they represent areas of strife which you have not been willing to handle thus far. They are quite available once you are determined to examine the complete contents of your conscious mind. If it strikes you as too intellectual a method, then you work backward from your emotions to your beliefs. In any case, regardless of which method you choose, one will lead you to the other. Both approaches require honesty with yourself and a firm encounter with the mental, psychic, and emotional aspects of your current reality. As with Andrea, you must accept the validity of your feelings while realizing that they are about certain issues or conditions and are not necessarily factual statements of your reality. I feel that I am a poor mother, or I feel that I am a failure. These are emotional statements and should be accepted as such. You are to understand, however, that while the feelings have their own integrity as emotions, they may not be statements of fact. You might be an excellent mother while feeling that you are quite inadequate. You may be most successful in reaching your goals while still thinking yourself a failure. By recognizing these differences and honestly following the feelings through, in other words, by writing the emotions, you will be led to the beliefs behind them. A series of self-revelations will inevitably result, each leading you to further creative psychological activity. At each stage, you will be closer to the reality of your own experience than you have ever been. The conscious mind will benefit greatly as it becomes more and more aware of its directing influence upon events. It will no longer fear the emotions or the body as threatening or unpredictable, but sense the greater unity in which it is involved. The emotions will not feel like stepchildren, with only the best dressed being admitted. They will not need to cry out for expression, for they will be fully admitted as members of the family of the self. Now again, some of you will say that your trouble is that you are too emotional, too sensitive. You may believe that you are too easily swayed. In such cases, you are afraid of your emotions. You think their power is so strong that all reason can be drowned within them. No matter how open it may seem that you are, you will nevertheless accept certain emotions that you think of as safe and ignore others or stop them at particular points because you are afraid of following them further. This behavior will follow your beliefs, of course. If you are over 40, for instance, you may tell yourself that age is meaningless, that you enjoy much younger people, that you think young thoughts. You will accept only those emotions that appear to be in keeping with your ideas of youth. You become concerned with the problems of the young. You accept what you think of as optimistic, health-giving thoughts. You consider yourself quite emotional, perhaps. Underneath, however, you are very much aware, as indeed you should be, of your reality in creaturehood. Yet you firmly ignore any changes in your appearance from the time you were, say, 30, and in so doing lose sight of your validity as a creature in space and time. You will inhibit any thoughts of dying or death or of old age, and so close out quite natural feelings that are meant to lead you beyond your earlier years. You are denying the body's corporal existence and its focus in the time of the seasons, and cheating yourself of those natural biological, psychic, and mental motions that are meant to take you past themselves. You may take your break. Now, in this particular context, one of the problems arises out of the connotations given to the words older or old. In your culture, you believe that to be young is to be flexible, alert, and aware. To be old or older is considered a disgrace, generally speaking, rigid, out of style, and passé. If you desperately try to remain young, it is usually to hide your own beliefs about age and to negate all of those emotions connected with it. Whenever you refuse to accept the reality of your creaturehood, you also reject aspects of your spirit. The body exists in the world of space and time. The experiences you may encounter in your 60s are as necessary as those in your 20s. Your changing image is supposed to tell you something. When you pretend alterations do not occur, you block both biological and spiritual messages. In old age, the organism is, in certain terms, preparing for a new birth. The combined events of spirit, mind, and body involve not only the passing of one season, but preparation for the beginning of another. The situation includes all of those supports necessary to carry you through, not only with acceptance, but with great aggressive drive toward new experience. To refute your reality in time, therefore, results in your being stuck in time and obsessed by it. Accepting your integrity in time allows the body to function until its natural end, in good condition, free from those distorted, invisible concepts about age. If you believe that youth is the ideal and struggle for it, while simultaneously believing that old age must involve infirmities, then you cause an unnecessary dilemma and hasten aging according to the negative aspects of your mind. Each individual must examine his or her individual beliefs or begin with feelings which will inevitably lead to them. In this area, as in all others, those of you who are proficient verbally might use the method of writing. Either write down your beliefs as they come to you or make lists of your intellectual and emotional assumptions. You may find that they are quite different. If you have a physical symptom, do not run away from it. Feel its reality in your body. Let the emotions follow freely. These will lead you, if you allow them to flow, to the beliefs that cause the difficulty. They will take you through many aspects of your own reality that you must face and explore. These methods release your withheld natural aggressiveness. You may feel that you are swamped by emotion, but trust it again. It is the motion of your being, and it arouses your own creativity. Followed, it will seek the answer to your problems. Rupert in his dialogues has an excellent example in the way in which he allowed his feelings to arise, though he was initially frightened of them. Everyone cannot write poetry, but each person is creative in his or her own way and can follow the emotions as Rupert did, whether or not a poem results. He will know the passage to which I refer. Use it. You must realize that your conscious mind is competent, its ideas pertinent, and that your own beliefs affect and form your body and your experience. You may take your break. Rob. Jane was very surprised to learn that she'd been in trance for almost half an hour, she thought, but a few minutes had passed. Here is part of the passage from her book of poetry referred to by Seth. Jane wrote it 5 days ago. In this excerpt, the mortal self tells the soul, Jane, but now my body trembles and breathes deep. Ancient angers rumble up from my toes. A dull, heavy black hole rises up through my belly to my throat and empties its load upon my tongue, which turns leaden with unsaid, uncried things, long forgotten by my mind, but clotted in my blood, ashen statues of unspoken vowels and syllables. Images I should have kicked all from my lips go toppling. The specifics merge. The ice-heavy mass grows alive in birth and rushes squalling out into the universe. Shapes and colors, blacks and purples mix with the skyscape's great moving picture and are lost and redeemed in it. And I feel you now, even in my anger, splendid and terrible, emerging through my flesh with the rightness of storm winds and clouds blowing, devastating the landscape, yet filling it with freshness, sending debris flying full blast and releasing new tubers, which lay hidden under and are justly served by my anger, which lifts them, and you and me all together, over repression's frosty land, surging in giant free swirls that burst like summer lightning, flashing and speeding over the countryside, joyously furious. Session 645, March 5, 1973. Reading from The Nature of Personal Reality, a Seth book by Jane Roberts, continuing Chapter 11. Good evening, Rob. Good evening, Seth. Seth, dictation. As you examine the contents of your conscious mind, it may seem to you that you hold so many different beliefs at different times that you cannot correlate them. They will, however, form into clear patterns. you will find a grouping of core beliefs with which the others gather. If you think of these as planets, then your other ideas orbit about them. There may be some invisible beliefs, and there may be one or two invisible core beliefs. These, following the analogy, would be hidden behind the other brighter, more obvious planets, and yet would show their presence through their effects upon your relationships with all of the other visible core beliefs in your planetary system. Questions you cannot seem to answer as you study your own ideas, for example, may lead you to suspect the existence of such invisible core beliefs. Let me emphasize that they are consciously available. You can find them through the approaches mentioned earlier. Rob notes in the last session, working from your feelings or by beginning with the beliefs that become most readily available. This subject leads to what I will call bridge beliefs, and again, Rupert received some information on this topic ahead of time for his own benefit. As you examine your ideas, you will discover that even some apparently contradictory ones have similarities, and these resemblances may be used to bridge the gaps between beliefs, even those that seem to be the most divisive. Because you are the individual who holds the beliefs, you will stamp them, so to speak, with certain characteristics that you will recognize. These aspects will themselves emerge as bridge beliefs. They contain great motion and energy. When you discover what they are, you will find a point of unity within yourself from which you can, with some detachment, view your other systems of belief. The emotions connected with these bridge beliefs may indeed surprise you. But standing upon such unifying structures, you are also free to let the emotional flow sweep past, feeling it, but aware for the first time, perhaps, of the origin of those feelings in your beliefs, and no longer afraid or being swept away by them. It is impossible to tell you of the emotional reality of such an experience. You will have to discover it for yourself. Such bridge beliefs often allow you to perceive the invisible beliefs mentioned this evening, and these can then appear to you as a revelation. On second thought, however, you will realize that another belief blocked that one from your view, but that you were always aware of it, and that in a strange way it was also invisible because you took it for granted. You did not consider it a belief about reality, but as reality itself, and never questioned it. Andrea never doubted the fact that life was more difficult for a woman than for a man. When she examined her beliefs, this escaped her. The invisible belief, however, affected her behavior and experience. Now she understands it and can deal with it as belief and not as a condition of reality over which she has no control. Bridge beliefs may become available to you in the dream state. If so, the conscious knowledge may appear suddenly in the middle of your waking day. A recollection will be felt within the self following such a conscious understanding, though the dream itself may not be consciously remembered. In the dream, various symbols may be used. Each person will vary in this regard. When such dreams are remembered, however, individual symbols such as crossing a river safely, or an ocean, or bridging a gap or an abyss are often involved. At such times, there can also be strong emotional content, as of finally triumphing over psychological chaos, or even of rising from the dead. You can suggest to yourself the emergence of such bridge beliefs. The conscious idea itself represents a statement of intent. Various core beliefs, not well assimilated, will give you conflicting self-images. Now, there is a difference between freely experimenting with and enjoying various styles of dress, attitudes, and behavior, and finding yourself lost in a compulsion to change your appearance, attitude, and behavior. This later usually involves contrary core beliefs that are alternately pulling you one way and then the other. Usually exaggerated, opposing emotions will also be apparent. Once you understand this, it is not difficult to look at your beliefs, to identify these, and to find a bridge to unite these seeming contradictions. You may take your break. Seth, dictation. Since this book was begun, Rupert has been working with his beliefs and using methods in his own way, as every reader must. When we began, he found it difficult to believe that so many answers were available in the conscious mind, and was astonished as he proceeded to discover that this was the case. I will use him here as an example to some extent, to show how a bridge belief appeared to assimilate what seemed to be diametrically opposing ideas. The same procedures will operate regardless of the particular beliefs held. Rupert is determined, persistent, stubborn, with great energy, creative, intuitive, and endowed with excellent flexibility of consciousness. He built his life around the core belief in himself as a writer. Through this belief, he viewed all of his experience, correlating it. He encouraged those impulses that furthered it and impeded those that did not. Now, because of this particular temperament, he put all of his eggs in one basket, so to speak. Those of you who do the same thing will see yourself in one particular way, whatever it is. You will primarily organize your experience along definite lines. It may be your sex role or your professional role. You may see yourself as a mother or a father, first of all, as a teacher, an editor, or as a man's man. You will, however, emphasize one certain quality above all others, your athletic nature, your spiritual bent, whatever it may be. Now, such concentration is excellent if the original concept continues to expand with your experience, and of itself is not limiting to a strong degree. You may see yourself primarily as a mother. Initially, that may simply involve taking care of your children at home. But if that idea of yourself remains limited, then it may preclude, say, even being a wife to your husband, deny you many complementary interests, and prevent expansion of your personality in other areas. In the same way, if your core belief stresses your spirituality to such an extent that it cuts off needed sensual expression, then it has become restrictive and will end up strangling even that spiritual experience that it was originally meant to express. As he worked with his beliefs, Rupert found himself in a position where he came face to face with two conflicting core beliefs. His writing self followed one belief, in which writing certain material was permissible and good. He had schooled himself to refute any opposing impulses and built his life along those lines from a young age. With the initiation of psychic experience, he found himself wanting to write about what happened to him and to use the material creatively. The previous beliefs in himself as a writer, however, clashed with those new urges because he did not consider anything but fiction as the work of a writer, except for poetry. He proceeded to make two divisions in his life, one psychic and the other, the writing self. The writing self looked askance at any creative material that did not come from the kinds of inspiration with which it was previously familiar. It insisted that other creative material come outside of Rupert's five-hour writing day. These beliefs generated their own emotions, of course, so that Rupert would become angry when thought of as a psychic by others. The same kind of dilemma can arise in any reader's experience whenever two strongly conflicting core beliefs meet. Rupert also believed in his psychic work, you see, and was fully committed to it. He developed some physical symptoms, and following through with his beliefs, he is working them out on his own. He saw for himself how they perfectly mirrored his inner image of himself. I gave him helpful information, but this could only be used by him as he felt it for himself and traveled through his own system of beliefs. When you understand the nature of reality and your part in forming it, then you can no longer look to others to solve your problems for you, and you realize that your own beliefs are the rich creative elements that you yourself must mix and match. If you think that certain foods will help you, then they will be effective in that system because of your beliefs. If you believe in doctors, then they will help you. If you believe in healers, then they can help you. But all of those aids are only temporary at best. Rupert was in a position where he realized that. He accepted the fact that he formed his own reality, and that there were physical aspects of it that disturbed him deeply. He also understood that he could not use me as a crutch. Rob notes, dialogues. See, the 639th session in Chapter 10 is now a book, just completed, but it also represented a movement of the self through a question and answer format, through which Rupert recognized and faced many diverse beliefs. Each reader can utilize the same method, whether or not artistic achievement is also involved, through objectifying personal beliefs in a dialogue form. This also happens frequently in the dream state, when you allow your natural creativity so much freedom. Often there are dreams of which you are two separate people, either strangers or familiar, each asking questions of the other. The day Rupert received the advance information on bridge beliefs, the obvious suddenly became clear. The writing self was finding itself more and more hampered, unable to use excellent material because of its limited beliefs. It focused so defensively on its own material that it was hampering its flow of creativity, while the unacceptable aspects of Rupert merrily went on creating other books, not even including my own. Rupert found himself bargaining with the early writing self and suddenly said, "What am I doing?" His core belief in himself as a writer, he saw, was really highly constrictive. He had not realized that before. At the same time, he had consciously known it, but allowed it to remain invisible. He realized that the writing and psychic aspects each did want to write, and this was the bridge belief. Using it, he is only now in the process of assimilating the newly available energy. He understands that he is the self who holds all of those beliefs and does not identify so completely with the one core belief any longer. That association was what had prevented its natural motion and expansion earlier. The original belief meant that he considered his reality in mental terms, generally identifying a writer with ideas and using his body as a vehicle rather than thinking of it as a living organism through which creaturehood experience must come. So this evening the senses were allowed their freedom, but the experience was magnified by his psychic sensitivity. If you consider yourself primarily physical, then you may, in line with your beliefs, impede your spiritual or emotional aspects. In that case, working with your beliefs will lead you to greater experience along mental and spiritual paths. But all are interconnected, and you cannot ignore one except at the expense of others. Now you may take a break. Seth, now, Rupert also saw that he believed he had to justify his existence through his writing. This because he did not trust the basic right of his being as it existed and does in space and time. These old beliefs had not caught up to his newer ones. The same artificial need to vindicate being is present in many of my readers, and various core beliefs may be built up to hide this inner insecurity. You may justify your life by biological creativity, and then latch onto your children and never want to let them go. You may use your career instead, but in all cases you must come to grips with some unnecessary ideas, face the reality of your creaturehood, and see that you certainly have as much of a place in the universe as a squirrel, an ant, or a leaf. You do not question their right to exist. Why question your own? And that is the end of our passionate session, and you may delete the word. Rob, thank you, Seth. Good night. Rob continues, those feelings even came up a couple of times while Seth was talking. Jane said, and her richly sensual responses continued. The feel of the bedsheets against her body was almost too much for an hour or so after the session. Traces of the experience lingered into the next day. A note added later, Rob. For some related material about the flexibility of Jane's perceptions, see our extensive notes for the 653rd session in Chapter 13, as well as those for the already mentioned 639th session. Session 646, March 7, 1973. Reading from The Nature of Personal Reality, a Seth book by Jane Roberts, continuing in Chapter 11. Good evening, Rob. Good evening, Seth. Seth. Now, dictation. When you allow your emotions their natural, spontaneous flow, they will never engulf you, and always return you refreshed to logical, conscious mind thought. It is only when you dam them up that they appear to be opposed to the intellect, or overwhelming. It is of the utmost importance, however, that you understand the power and directing nature of your conscious mind. For otherwise, you will believe yourself to be forever at the mercy of conditions and situations over which you feel you have no control. Again, while the conscious mind is meant to direct the flow of your experience through your beliefs and to materialize them, the actual mechanics are taken care of automatically by other portions of the self. You must indeed trust that your new beliefs will work as completely for you as your old ones. It may seem that your religious beliefs have little to do with your health or with your day-to-day experience. Those of you who have left organized religions may feel relatively free from what you consider to be the adverse connotations of original sin and the like. Yet no one is free of belief of any kind in that area. Indeed, a belief in atheism is a belief. In the next chapter, let us consider more closely your ideas about good and evil, the morality of the self, and examine the ways in which your ideas are reflected in your lives. End of chapter. Now, a note to the woman whose letter you have there. Give us a moment. No man or woman consciously knows for sure which day will be the last for him or her in this particular life that each calls the present one. Mortality, with its birth and death, is the framework in which the soul, for now, is expressed in flesh. Birth and death contain between them the earthly experience that you perceive as happening within a given period of time, through various seasons and involving unique perceptions within areas of space, encountered with other human beings, all to one extent or another, sharing with you events caused by the intersection of the self and time and space. Birth and death then have their function, intensifying and focusing your attention. Life seems more dear in your terms, corporal terms, because of the existence of death. It seems, perhaps, easier to have no conscious idea of the year or time that death might occur. Unconsciously, of course, each man and woman knows and yet hides the knowledge. The knowledge is usually hidden for many reasons, but the fact of death, personal death, is never forgotten. It seems obvious, but the full enjoyment of life would be impossible in the framework now of earthly reality without the knowledge of death. You have been given an opportunity to study life and to experience it more fully than you ever have before in this existence. Its intensity and brilliance, its contrasts and similarities, its joys and its sorrows are here for you to perceive, whose eyes are opened by the fact of the doctor's pronouncement. Now I tell you that intensification appreciated and understood, and the experience of life and living accepted unconditionally, can bring you, in this life, another birth, in which the doctor's pronouncements are meaningless. Spiritually, the death sentence given you is another chance at life. If you are freely able to accept life with all of its conditions and to feel its full dimensions, for that alone will rejuvenate your spirit and physical self. The experience that you wrote of was significant on several levels, and of course was meant to reassure you ahead of time because of the events you knew would occur. The experience was to inform you emotionally and spiritually of the great meaning of each individual, portray the loving brilliance that is within each human being, and let you know that the integrity of the self and the soul exists beyond the possibility of annihilation, as you yourself will continue to exist regardless of which path you choose to take, dying within 2 years or living physically on for many more. In other words, you will continue to exist and be fulfilled within that love you sensed. You felt before, unconsciously, that you were drifting and that life had little meaning. Beneath the surface of events, you felt unfulfilled and felt that you had great courage and abilities, with never a chance to use them, and no heroic episodes then to rouse you to fuller understanding, and no real impetus to lift you or to bring excitement into your days. Unconsciously, therefore, you chose a situation in which a crisis was precipitated, rousing all the greatest elements of heart and soul, so that they must strain to understand, to perceive, to triumph. And so you shall, in whatever way is most important to you, and you will learn more and be more fulfilled than you would have been had those conditions not been initiated. This does not mean that there were not other ways available that you could have chosen. You chose the set of conditions that you did because in past existences you were so terrified of death that you tried to hide its knowledge from yourself, and this time you placed it in the forefront of your attention. In the entire fabric of your existence, this life is a brilliant, eternally unique and precious portion, but only a portion from which you emerge with joy and understanding, whether you die tomorrow or in years to come. The choice of life and death is always yours. Life and death are but two faces of your eternal, ever-changing existence, however. Feel and appreciate the joy of your own being. Many live into their 90s without ever appreciating to the extent the beauty of their being. You have lived before and will again, and your new life, in your terms, springs out of the old and is growing in the old and contained within it as the seed is already contained within the flower. We are all travelers, whatever our portion. And as one traveler to another, I salute you. End of reply. You may take your break. Seth. But this wasn't break after all. Instead, Seth decided to relay a page of material for Jane and me before launching into chapter 12. Break lasted from 11:22 to 11:40.